Disc 6.
You're assuming too much, Michael. You're assuming the firm wants to talk to you. Frankly, they don't. They are highly agitated by the theft of the file and by your refusal to return it. You can't blame them. Get their attention, Barry. This file is front page news, big, bold headlines with noisy journalists following up with a dozen stories. If I get arrested, I'll go straight to the Post. You've lost your mind. Probably so. Chance had a paralegal named Hector Palma. Have you heard of him? No. You're out of the loop. I never claimed to be in. Palma knows too much about the file. As of yesterday, he no longer works where he worked last week. I don't know where he is, but it would be interesting to find out. Ask Arthur. Just give the file back, Michael. I don't know what you're planning to do with it, but you can't use it in court. I took my coffee and stepped off the stool. A truce for 1 week, I said, walking away, and tell Arthur to put you in the loop. Arthur doesn't take orders from you, he snapped at me. I left quickly, darting through people on the sidewalk, practically running toward DuPont Circle, anxious to leave behind Barry and anyone else they'd sent along to spy. The Palmas' address, according to the phone book, was an apartment building in Bethesda. Since I was in no hurry and needed to think, I circled the city on the beltway, bumper to bumper with a million others. I gave myself 50-50 odds of being arrested within the week. The firm had no choice but to come after me, and if Braden Chance was in fact hiding the truth from Arthur and the executive committee, then why not play hardball? There was enough circumstantial evidence of my theft to convince a magistrate to issue an arrest warrant. The Mr. episode had rattled the firm. Chance had been called onto the carpet, grilled at length by the brass, and it was inconceivable that he admitted any deliberate wrongdoing. He lied, and he did so with the hope that he could doctor the file and somehow survive. His victims, after all, were only a bunch of homeless squatters. How then was he able to dispose of Hector so quickly? Money was no object. Chance was a partner. If I had been Chance, I would have offered cash to Hector. Cash on one hand with the threat of immediate termination on the other. And I would have called a partner buddy in, say, Denver and asked for a favor, a quick transfer for a paralegal. It would not have been difficult. Hector was away, hiding from me and anyone else who came with questions. He was still employed, probably at a higher salary. Then what about the polygraph? Had it been simply a threat used by the firm against both Hector and myself? Could he have taken the test and passed? I doubted it. Chance needed Hector to keep the truth hidden. Hector needed Chance to protect his job. At some point, the partner blocked any notion of a polygraph, if in fact it had been seriously considered. The apartment complex was long and rambling, new sections added as the sprawl moved northward away from the city. The streets around it were packed with fast food, fast gas, video rentals, everything hurried commuters needed to save time. I parked next to a frozen pool and some tennis courts and began a tour of the various units. I took my time. There was no place to go after this adventure. District cops could be lurking anywhere with a warrant and handcuffs. I tried not to think of the horror stories I'd heard about the city jail, but one stuck like a cattle brand seared into my memory. Several years earlier, a young Drake and Sweeney associate spent several hours after work on Friday drinking in a bar in Georgetown. As he was trying to get to Virginia, he was arrested on suspicion of driving under the influence. At the police station, he refused a breath test and was immediately thrown into the drunk tank. The cell was overcrowded. He was the only guy with a suit, the only guy with a nice watch, fine loafers, white face. He accidentally stepped on the foot of a fellow inmate, and he was then beaten to a bloody mess. He spent 3 months in a hospital getting his face rebuilt, then went home to Wilmington where his family took care of him. The brain damage was slight, but enough to disqualify him for the rigors of a big firm. The first office was closed. I trudged along a sidewalk in search of another. The phone address did not list an apartment number. It was a safe complex. There were bikes and plastic toys on the small patios. Through the windows, I could see families eating and watching television. The windows were not defended by rows of bars. The cars crammed into the parking lots were of the mid-sized commuter variety, mostly clean and with all four hubcaps. A security guard stopped me. Once he determined that I posed no threat, he pointed in the direction of the main office, at least a quarter of a mile away. "How many units are in this place?" I asked. "A lot," he answered. "Why should he know the number?" The night manager was a student eating a sandwich, a physics textbook open before him, but he was watching the Bullets-Knicks game on a small TV. I asked about Hector Palma, and he pecked away on a keyboard. G-134 was the number.
"But they've moved," he said with a mouthful of food.
"Yeah, I know," I said. "I worked with Hector. Friday was his last day. I'm looking for an apartment, and I was wondering if I could see his." He was shaking his head no before I finished. "Only on Saturdays, man. We have 900 units, and there's a waiting list." "I'm gone on Saturday." "Sorry," he said, taking another bite and glancing at the game. I removed my wallet. "How many bedrooms?" I asked. He glanced at the monitor. "Two." Hector had 4 children. I was sure his new digs were more spacious. "How much a month?"
$750.
I took out a $100 bill, which he immediately saw. "Here's the deal. Give me the key, I'll take a look at the place and be back in 10 minutes. No one will ever know."
"We have a waiting list,"
he said again, dropping the sandwich onto a paper plate. "Is it there in that computer?" I asked, pointing.
"Yeah,"
he said, wiping his mouth. "Then it would be easy to shuffle." He found the key in a locked drawer and grabbed the money.
10 minutes, he said.
The apartment was nearby, on the ground floor of a 3-story building. The key worked. The smell of fresh paint escaped through the door before I went inside. In fact, the painting was still in progress. In the living room, there was a ladder, drop cloths, white buckets. A team of fingerprinters could not have found a trace of the Palma clan. All drawers, cabinets, and closets were bare, all carpets and padding ripped up and gone. Even the tub and toilet bowl stains had been removed. No dust, cobwebs, dirt under the kitchen sink. The place was sterile. Every room had a fresh coat of dull white, except the living room, which was half finished. I returned to the office and tossed the key on the counter.
"How about it?" he asked.
"Too small," I said, "but thanks anyway."
"You want your money back?"
"Are you in school?"
"Yes."
"Then keep it."
"Thanks."
I stopped at the door and asked, "Did Palma leave a forwarding address?"
"I thought you worked with him," he said.
"Right," I said, and quickly closed the door behind me. Chapter 22. The little woman was sitting against our door when I arrived for work Wednesday morning. It was almost 8. The office was locked. The temperature was below freezing. At first I thought she had parked herself there for the night, using our doorway to battle the wind. But when she saw me approach, she immediately jumped to her feet and said, "Good morning." I smiled and said hello and started fumbling keys.
"Are you a lawyer?" she asked.
"Yes, I am."
"For people like me?"
I assumed she was homeless, and that was all we asked of our clients.
"Sure.
Be my guest," I said as I opened the door. It was colder inside than out. I adjusted a thermostat, one that, as far as I had been able to determine, was connected to nothing. I made coffee and found some stale donuts in the kitchen. I offered them to her, and she quickly ate one.
"What's your name?"
I asked. We were sitting at the front next to Sophia's desk, waiting for the coffee and praying for the radiators.
"Ruby?"
"I'm Michael. Where do you live, Ruby?"
"Here and there."
She was dressed in a gray Georgetown Hoya sweatshirt, thick brown socks, dirty white sneakers with no brand name. She was between 30 and 40, rail thin and slightly cockeyed. "Come on," I said with a smile. "I need to know where you live. Is it a shelter?"
"Used to live in a shelter, but had to leave. Almost got raped. I got a car."
I had seen no vehicles parked near the office when I arrived.
"You have a car?"
"Yes."
"Do you drive it?"
"It don't drive. I sleep in the back."
I was asking questions without a legal pad, something I was not trained to do. I poured 2 large paper cups of coffee and we retreated to my office, where mercifully the radiator was alive and gurgling. I closed the door. Mordecai would arrive shortly, and he had never learned the art of a quiet entry. Ruby sat on the edge of my brown folding client's chair, her shoulders slumped, her entire upper body wrapped around the cup of coffee, as if it might be the last warm thing in life. "What can I do for you?" I asked, armed with a full assortment of legal pads.
"It's my son, Terrence. He's 16, and they've taken him away."
"Who took him?"
"The city, the foster people."
"Where is he now?"
"They got him."
Her answers were short, nervous bursts, quick on the heels of each question. "Why don't you relax and tell me about Terrence?" I said. And she did. With no effort at eye contact and with both hands on the coffee cup, she zipped through her narrative. Several years earlier, she couldn't remember how long, but Terrence was around 10. They were living alone in a small apartment. She was arrested for selling drugs. She went to jail for 4 months. Terrence went to live with her sister. Upon her release, she collected Terrence, and they began a nightmare existence living on the streets. They slept in cars, squatted in empty buildings, slept under bridges in warm weather, and retreated to the shelters when it was cold. Somehow, she kept him in school. She begged on the sidewalk, she sold her body, tricking, as she called it. She peddled a little crack. She did whatever it took to keep Terrence fed, in decent clothes, and in school. But she was an addict and couldn't kick the crack. She became pregnant, and when the child was born, the city took it immediately. It was a crack baby. She seemed to have no affection for the baby, only for Terrence. The city began asking questions about him, and mother and child slid deeper into the shadows of the homeless. Out of desperation, she went to a family she had once worked for as a maid, the Rowlands, a couple whose children were grown and away from home. They had a warm little house near Howard University. She offered to pay them $50 a month if Terrence could live with them. There was a small bedroom above the back porch, one she'd cleaned many times, and it would be perfect for Terrence. The Rowlands hesitated at first, but finally agreed. They were good people back then. Ruby was allowed to visit Terrence for an hour each night. His grades improved, he was clean and safe, and Ruby was pleased with herself. She rearranged her life around his. New soup kitchens and dinner programs closer to the Rowlands, different shelters for emergencies, different alleys and parks and abandoned cars. She scraped together the money each month and never missed a nightly visit with her son. Until she was arrested again. The first arrest was for prostitution. The second was for sleeping on a park bench in Farragut Square. Maybe there was a third one, but she couldn't remember. She was rushed to D.C. General once when someone found her lying in a street unconscious. She was placed in a dry-out tank for addicts, but walked out after 3 days because she missed Terrence. She was with him one night in his room when he stared at her stomach and asked if she was pregnant again. She said she thought so. "Who was the father?" he demanded. She had no idea. He cursed her and yelled so much that the Rowlands asked her to leave. While she was pregnant, Terrence had little to do with her. It was heartbreaking, sleeping in cars, begging for coins, counting the hours until she could see him, then being ignored for an hour while she sat in a corner of his room watching him do his homework. Ruby began crying at that point in her story. I made some notes and listened as Mordecai stomped around the front room trying to pick a fight with Sophia. Her third delivery, only a year before, produced another crack baby, one immediately taken by the city. She didn't see Terrence for 4 days while she was in the hospital recovering the birth. When she was released, she returned to the only life she knew. Terrence was an A student, excellent in math and Spanish, a trombone player, and an actor in school dramas. He was dreaming of the Naval Academy. Mr. Rowland had served in the military. Ruby arrived one night for a visit in bad shape. A fight started in the kitchen when Mrs. Rowland confronted her. Harsh words were exchanged, ultimatums thrown down. Terrence was in the middle of it, 3 against 1. Either she got help, or she would be banned from the house. Ruby declared that she would simply take her boy and leave. Terrence said he wasn't going anywhere. The next night, a social worker from the city was waiting for her with paperwork. Someone had already been to court. Terrence was being taken into foster care. The Rowlands would be his new parents. He had already lived with them for 3 years. Visitation would be terminated until she underwent rehab and was clean for a period of 60 days. 3 weeks had passed.
I want to see my son, she said. I miss him so bad.
Are you in rehab? I asked.
She shook her head quickly and closed her eyes.
Why not? I asked.
Can't get in?
I had no idea how a crack addict off the street got admitted to a recovery unit, but it was time to find out. I pictured Terence in his warm room, well-fed, well-dressed, safe, clean, sober, doing his homework under the strict supervision of Mr. and Mrs. Rowland, who had grown to love him almost as much as Ruby did. I could see him eating breakfast at the family table, reciting vocabulary lists over hot cereal as Mr. Rowland ignored the morning paper and grilled him on his Spanish. Terence was stable and normal, unlike my poor little client, who lived in hell. And she wanted me to handle their reunion.
This will take some time, okay? I said, thoroughly clueless about how long anything would take. In a city where 500 families waited for a small space in an emergency shelter, there couldn't be many beds available for drug addicts.
You won't see Terence until you're drug-free, I said, trying not to sound pious. Her eyes watered and she said nothing. I realized just how little I knew about addiction. Where did she get her drugs? How much did they cost? How many hits and highs each day? How long would it take her to dry out, then to cure her? What were her chances of kicking a habit she'd had for over a decade? And what did the city do with all those crack babies? She had no paperwork, no address, no identification, nothing but a heartbreaking story. She seemed perfectly content sitting in my chair, and I began to wonder how I might ask her to leave. The coffee was gone. Sophia's shrill voice brought back reality. There were sharp voices around her. As I raced for the door, my first thought was that another nut like Mister had walked in with a gun. But there were other guns. Lieutenant Gasco was back, again with plenty of help. Three uniformed cops were approaching Sophia, who was bitching unmercifully, but to no avail. Two in jeans and sweatshirts were waiting for action. As I walked out of my office, Mordecai walked out of his.
"Hello, Mikey," Gasco said to me.
"What the hell is this?"
Mordecai growled, and the wall shook. One of the uniformed cops actually reached for his service revolver. Gasco went straight for Mordecai.
"It's a search,"
he said, pulling out the required papers and flinging them at Mordecai.
"Are you Mr. Green?"
"I am,"
he answered, snatching the papers.
"What are you looking for?" I yelled at Gasco.
"Same thing," he yelled back. "Give it to us and we'll be happy to stop."
"It's not here."
"What file?"
Mordecai asked, looking at the search warrant. "The eviction file," I replied.
"Haven't seen your lawsuit," Gasco said to me.
I recognized two of the uniformed cops as Lily and Blower.
"A lot of big talk," Gasco said.
"Get the hell out of here,"
Sophia barked at Blower as he inched toward her desk. Gasco was very much in charge.
"Listen, lady," he said with his usual sneer. "We can do this two ways. First, you put your ass in that chair and shut up. Second, we put the cuffs on you and you sit in the back of a car for the next 2 hours.
One cop was poking his head into each of the side offices. I felt Ruby ease behind me.
"Relax," Mordecai said to Sophia. "Just relax."
"What's upstairs?"
Gasco asked me.
I had no idea.
"Storage,"
Mordecai replied.
"Your storage?"
"Yes."
"It's not there," I said. "You're wasting your time."
"Then we'll have to waste it, won't we?"
A prospective client opened the front door, startling those of us inside. His eyes darted quickly around the room, then settled on the three men in uniform. He made a hasty retreat into the safety of the streets. I asked Ruby to leave too. Then I stepped into Mordecai's office and closed the door.
"Where's the file?" he asked in a low voice.
"It's not here, I swear. This is just harassment."
"The warrant looks valid. There's been a theft. It's reasonable to assume the file would be with the attorney who stole it."
I tried to say something lawyerly and bright, some piercing legal nugget that would stop the search cold and send the cops running. But words failed me. Instead, I was embarrassed at having brought the police to nose through the clinic.
"Do you have a copy of the file?" he asked.
"Yes."
"Have you thought about giving him the original?"
"I can't. That would be an admission of guilt.
They don't know for a fact that I have the file. And even if I gave it back, they would know that I had copied it.
He rubbed his beard and agreed with me. We stepped out of his office just as Lily missed a step near the unused desk next to Sophia's. An avalanche of files slid onto the floor. Sophia yelled at him. Gasco yelled at her. Attention was quickly moving away from words and in the direction of physical conflict. I locked the front door so our clients wouldn't see the search.
"Here's the way we'll do it," Mordecai announced.
The cops glared, but they were anxious for some direction. Searching a law office was quite unlike raiding a bar filled with minors.
"The file isn't here, okay? We'll start with that promise. You can look at all the files you want, but you can't open them. That would violate client confidentiality. Agreed?"
The other cops looked at Gasco, who shrugged as if that was acceptable. We started in my office. All six cops, me and Mordecai, crammed into the tiny room, working hard at avoiding contact. I opened each drawer of my desk, none of which would open unless yanked viciously. At one point, I heard Gasco whisper to himself, "Nice office." I removed each file from my cabinets, waved them under Gasco's nose, and returned them to their place. I'd only been there since Monday, so there wasn't much to search. Mordecai slipped from the room and went to Sophia's desk where he used the phone. When Gasco declared my office to be officially searched, we left it just in time to hear Mordecai say into the receiver,
"Yes, Judge, thank you, he's right here."
His smile showed every tooth as he thrust the phone at Gasco.
"This is Judge Kistner, the gentleman who signed the search warrant. He would like to speak to you."
Gasco took the phone as if it were owned by a leper. "This is Gasco," he said, holding it inches from his head. Mordecai turned to the other cops.
"Gentlemen, you may search this room, and that's it. You cannot go into the private offices to the sides. Judge's orders."
Gasco mumbled,
"Yes, sir,"
and hung up. We monitored their movements for an hour as they went from desk to desk, four of them in all, including Sophia's. After a few minutes, they realized the search was futile, and so they prolonged it by moving as slowly as possible. Each desk was covered with files long since closed, the books and legal publications had last been looked at years earlier. Some stacks were covered with dust. A few cobwebs had to be dealt with. Each file was tabbed with a case name, either typed or hand-printed. Two of the cops wrote down the names of the files as they were called out by Gasco and the others. It was tedious and utterly hopeless. They saved Sophia's desk for last. She handled things herself, calling off the name of each file, spelling the simpler ones like Jones, Smith, Williams. The cops kept their distance. She opened drawers just wide enough for a quick peek. She had a personal drawer, which no one wanted to see. I was sure there were weapons in there. They left without saying goodbye. I apologized to Sophia and Mordecai for the intrusion and retreated to the safety of my office. Chapter 23. Number 5 on the list of evictees was Kelvin Lamb, a name vaguely familiar to Mordecai. He once estimated the number of homeless in the district to be around 10,000. There were at least that many files scattered throughout the 14th Street Legal Clinic. Every name rang a bell with Mordecai. He worked the circuits, the kitchens and shelters and service providers, the preachers and cops and other street lawyers. After dark, we drove downtown to a church wedged between high-priced office buildings and ritzy hotels. In a large basement, two levels below, the Five Loaves dinner program was in full swing. The room was lined with folding tables, all surrounded by hungry folks eating and talking. It was not a soup kitchen. The plates were filled with corn, potatoes, a slice of something that was either turkey or chicken, fruit salad, bread. I had not eaten dinner, and the aroma made me hungry.
"I haven't been here in years," Mordecai said as we stood by the entrance, looking down at the dining area. "They feed 300 a day. Isn't it wonderful?"
"Where does the food come from?"
"DC Central Kitchen, an outfit in the basement of the CCNV. They've developed this amazing system of collecting excess food from local restaurants. Not leftovers, but uncooked food that will simply go bad if not used immediately.
They have a fleet of refrigerated trucks, and they run all over the city collecting food, which they take to the kitchen and prepare frozen dinners, over 2,000 a day.
It looks tasty.
It's really quite good.
A young lady named Liza found us. She was new at Five Loaves. Mordecai had known her predecessor, whom they talked about briefly as I watched the people eat. I noticed something I should have seen before. There were different levels of homelessness, distinct rungs on the socioeconomic ladder. At one table, six men ate and talked happily about a basketball game they had seen on television. They were reasonably well-dressed. One wore gloves while he ate, and except for that, the group could have been sitting in any working-class bar in the city without being immediately branded as homeless. Behind them, a hulking figure with thick sunglasses ate alone, handling the chicken with his fingers. He had rubber boots similar to the ones Mr. wore at the time of his death. His coat was dirty and frayed. He was oblivious to his surroundings. His life was noticeably harder than the lives of the men laughing at the next table. They had access to warm water and soap. He couldn't have cared less. They slept in shelters. He slept in parks with the pigeons. But they were all homeless. Liza did not know Kelvin Lamb, but she would ask around. We watched her as she moved through the crowd, speaking to the people, pointing to the wastebaskets in one corner, fussing over an elderly lady. She sat between two men, neither of whom looked at her as they talked. She went to another table, then another. Most surprisingly, a lawyer appeared, a young associate from a large firm, a pro bono volunteer with the Washington Legal Clinic for the Homeless. He recognized Mordecai from a fundraiser the year before. We did law talk for a few minutes, then he disappeared into a back room to begin 3 hours of intake. "The Washington Legal Clinic has 150 volunteers," Mordecai said. "Is that enough?" I asked. "It's never enough. I think we should revive our pro bono volunteer program. Maybe you'd like to take charge and supervise it. Abraham likes the idea." It was nice to know that Mordecai and Abraham, and no doubt Sophia, too, had been discussing a new program for me to renew and run. "It will expand our base, make us more visible in the legal community, and help with raising money." "Sure," I said, without conviction. Liza was back. "Kelvin Lamb is in the rear," she said, nodding, "second table from the back, wearing the Redskins cap." "Did you talk to him?" Mordecai asked. "Yes. He's sober, pretty sharp, says he's been staying at CCNV, works part-time on a garbage truck." "Is there a small room we can use?" "Sure. Tell Lamb a homeless lawyer needs to talk to him." Lamb didn't say hello or offer to shake hands. Mordecai sat at a table. I stood in a corner. Lamb took the only available chair and gave me a look that made my skin crawl. "Nothing's wrong," Mordecai said in his best soothing tone. "We need to ask you a few questions, that's all." Not a peep out of Lamb. He was dressed like a resident of a shelter, jeans, sweatshirt, sneakers, wool jacket, as opposed to the pungent, multi-layered garb of one sleeping under a bridge. "Do you know a woman named Lante Burton?" Mordecai asked. He would do the talking for us lawyers. Lamb shook his head no. "Devon Hardy?" Another no. "Last month, were you living in an abandoned warehouse?"
"Yep."
"At the corner of New York and Florida?"
"Uh-huh."
"Were you paying rent?"
"Yep."
$100 a month?"
"Yep."
"To Tillman Gantry?" Lamb froze and closed his eyes to ponder the question.
"Who?"
he asked. "Who owned the warehouse?"
"I pay rent to some dude named Johnny."
"Who did Johnny work for?"
"Don't know. Don't care. Didn't ask."
"How long did you live there?"
"About 4 months."
"Why did you leave?"
"Got evicted."
"Who evicted you?"
"I don't know. The cops showed up one day with some other dudes. They yanked us and threw us on the sidewalk. Couple days later, they bulldozed the warehouse."
"Did you explain to the cops that you were paying rent to live there?"
"A lot of people were saying that. This one woman with little kids tried to fight with the police, but didn't do no good. Me, I don't fight with cops. It was a bad scene, man.
Were you given any paperwork before the eviction?
No.
Any notice to get out?
No, nothing. They just showed up.
Nothing in writing?
Nothing. Cops said we were just squatters, had to get out right then.
So you moved in last fall, sometime around October?
Something like that.
How did you find the place?
I don't know. Somebody said they were renting little apartments in the warehouse. Cheap rent, you know. So I went over to check it out. They were putting up some boards and walls and things. There was a roof up there, a toilet not far away, running water. It wasn't a bad deal.
So you moved in,
right?
Did you sign a lease?
No. Dude told me that the apartment was illegal, so nothing was in writing. Told me to say I was squatting in case anybody asked.
And he wanted cash.
Only cash.
Did you pay every month?
Tried to. We came around on the 15th to collect.
Were you behind on your rent when you were evicted?
A little.
How much?
Maybe 1 month.
Was that the reason you were evicted?
I don't know. They didn't give no reason. They just evicted everybody all at once.
Did you know the other people in the warehouse?
I knew a couple, but we kept to ourselves. Each apartment had a good door, one that would lock.
This mother you mentioned, the one who fought with the police, did you know her?
No. I maybe seen her once or twice. She lived on the other end.
The other end?
Right. There was no plumbing in the middle of the warehouse, so they built the apartments on each end.
Could you see her apartment from yours?
No, it was a big warehouse.
How big was your apartment?
2 rooms. I don't know how big.
Electricity?
Yeah, they ran some wires in. We could plug in radios and things like that. We had lights. There was running water, but you had to use a community toilet.
What about heating?
Not much. It got cold, but not nearly as cold as sleeping on the street.
So you were happy with the place?
It was okay. I mean, for $100 a month, it wasn't bad.
You said you knew 2 other people. What are their names?
Herman Harris and Shine somebody.
Where are they now?
I haven't seen them.
Where are you staying?
CCMV.
Mordecai pulled a business card from his pocket and handed it to Lamb. How long will you be there? He asked.
I don't know.
Can you keep in touch with me?
Why?
You might need a lawyer. Just call me if you change shelters or find a place you own.
Lamb took the card without a word. We thanked Liza and returned to the office. As with any lawsuit, there were a number of ways to proceed with our action against the defendants. There were 3 of them, River Oaks, Drake and Sweeney, and TAG, and we did not expect to add more. The first method was the ambush. The other was the serve and volley. With the ambush, we would prepare the skeletal framework of our allegations, run to the courthouse, file the suit, leak it to the press, and hope we could prove what we thought we knew. The advantage was surprise and embarrassment for the defendants, and hopefully public opinion. The downside was the legal equivalent of jumping off a cliff with the strong but unconfirmed belief that there was a net down there somewhere. The serve and volley would begin with a letter to the defendants, in which we made the same allegations, but rather than sue, we would invite them to discuss the matter. The letters would go back and forth, with each side generally able to predict what the other might do. If liability could be proved, then a quiet settlement would probably occur. Litigation could be avoided. The ambush appealed to Mordecai and myself for 2 reasons. The firm had shown no interest in leaving me alone. The 2 searches were clear proof that Arthur on the top floor and Rafter and his band of hardasses in litigation were coming after me. My arrest would make a nice news story, one they would undoubtedly leak to humiliate me and build pressure. We had to be ready with our own assault. The 2nd reason went to the heart of our case. Hector and the other witnesses could not be compelled to testify until we filed suit and forced them to give their depositions. During the discovery period that followed the initial filing, we would have the opportunity to ask all sorts of questions of the defendants, and they would be required to answer under oath. We would also be allowed to depose anybody we wanted. If we found Hector Palma, we could grill him under oath.
If we tracked down the other evictees, we could force them to tell what happened. We had to find out what everyone knew, and there was no way to do this without using court-sanctioned discovery. In theory, our case was really quite simple. The warehouse squatters had been paying rent, in cash with no records, to Tillman Gantry or someone working on his behalf. Gantry had an opportunity to sell the property to River Oaks, but it had to be done quickly. Gantry lied to River Oaks and its lawyers about the squatters. Drake and Sweeney, exercising diligence, had sent Hector Palma to inspect the property prior to closing. Hector was mugged on the first visit, took a guard with him on the second, and upon inspecting the premises learned that the residents were, in fact, not squatters, but tenants. He reported this in a memo to Braden Chance, who made the ill-fated decision to disregard it and proceed with the closing. The tenants were summarily evicted as squatters without due process. A formal eviction would have taken at least 30 days, time none of the participants wanted to waste. 30 days, and the worst of winter would be gone. The threat of snowstorms or sub-zero nights would be diminished, along with the need to sleep in a car with the heater running. They were just street people, with no records, no rent receipts, and no trail to be followed. It was not a complicated case, in theory. But the hurdles were enormous. Locking in testimony of homeless people could be treacherous, especially if Mr. Gantry decided to assert himself. He ruled the streets, an arena I was not eager to fight in. Mordecai had a vast network built on favors and whispers, but he was no match for Gantry's artillery. We spent an hour discussing various ways to avoid naming TAG Inc. as a defendant. For obvious reasons, the lawsuit would be far messier and more dangerous with Gantry as a party. We could sue without him and leave it to his co-defendants, River Oaks and Drake and Sweeney, to haul him in as a third party. But Gantry was a contributing cause in our theory of liability, and to ignore him as a defendant would be to ask for trouble as the case progressed. Hector Palma had to be found, and once we found him, we somehow had to convince him to either produce the hidden memo or to tell us what was in it. Finding him would be the easy part. Getting him to talk might be impossible. He quite likely wouldn't want to, since he needed to keep his job. He'd been quick to tell me he had a wife and four kids. There were other problems with the lawsuit, the first of which was purely procedural. We, as lawyers, did not have the authority to file suit on behalf of the heirs of Lante Burton and her four children. We had to be employed by her family, such as it was. With her mother and two brothers in prison, and her father's identity yet to be revealed, Mordecai was of the opinion we should petition the family court for the appointment of a trustee to handle the affairs of Lante's estate. In doing so, we could bypass her family, at least initially. In the event we recovered damages, the family would be a nightmare. It was safe to assume that the four children had two or more different fathers, and each one of those tomcats would have to be notified if money changed hands. "We'll worry about that later," Mordecai said. "We have to win first." We were in the front, at the desk next to Sophia's, where the aging computer worked most of the time. I was typing, Mordecai pacing and dictating. We plotted until midnight, drafting and redrafting the lawsuit, arguing theories, discussing procedure, dreaming of ways to haul River Oaks and my old firm into court for a noisy trial. Mordecai saw it as a watershed, a pivotal moment to reverse the decline in public sympathy for the homeless. I saw it simply as a way to correct a wrong. Chapter 24. Coffee again with Ruby. She was waiting by the front door when I arrived at 7:45, happy to see me. How could anyone be so cheerful after spending 8 hours trying to sleep in the back seat of an abandoned car? "Got any donuts?" she asked as I was flipping on the light switches. It was already a habit. "I'll see. You have a seat and I'll make us some coffee." I rattle around the kitchen, cleaning the coffee pot, looking for something to eat. Yesterday's stale donuts were even firmer, but there was nothing else. I made a mental note to buy fresh ones tomorrow, just in case Ruby arrived for the third day in a row. Something told me she would.
She ate one donut, nibbling around the hard edges, trying to be polite.
"Where do you eat breakfast?" I asked.
"Don't, usually."
"How about lunch and dinner?"
"Lunch is at Naomi's on 10th Street. For dinner, I go to Calvary Mission over on 15th.
"What do you do during the day?"
She was curled around her paper cup again, trying to keep her frail body warm.
"Most of the time I stay at Naomi's," she said.
"How many women are there?"
"Don't know. A lot. They take good care of us, but it's just for the day."
"Is it only for homeless women?"
"Yeah, that's right. They close at 4. Most of the women live in shelters, some on the street. Me, I got a car."
"Do they know you're using crack?"
"I think so. They want me to go to meetings for drunks and people on dope. I'm not the only one. Lots of the women do it too, you know."
"Did you get high last night?" I asked. The words echoed in my ears. I found it hard to believe I was asking such questions. Her chin fell to her chest. Her eyes closed.
"Tell me the truth," I said.
"I had to. I do it every night."
I wasn't about to scold her. I had done nothing since the day before to help her find treatment. It suddenly became my priority. She asked for another donut. I wrapped the last one in foil and topped off her coffee. She was late for something at Naomi's, and off she went.
The March for Lante began at the district building with a rally for justice. Since Mordecai was a who's who in the world of the homeless, he left me in the crowd and went to his spot on the platform. A church choir robed in burgundy and gold got organized on the steps and began flooding the area with lively hymns. Hundreds of police loitered in loose formation up and down the street, their barricades stopping traffic. The CCNV had promised 1,000 of its foot soldiers, and they arrived in a group, one long, impressive, disorganized column of men, homeless and proud of it. I heard them coming before I saw them, their well-rehearsed marching yells clear from blocks away. When they rounded the corner, the TV cameras scrambled to greet them. They gathered intact before the steps of the district building and began waving their placards, most of which were of the homemade, hand-painted variety. "Stop the killings. Save the shelters. I have the right to a home. Jobs, jobs, jobs." The signs were hoisted above their heads, where they danced with the rhythm of the hymns and the cadence of each noisy chant. Church buses stopped at the barricades and unloaded hundreds of people, many of whom did not appear to be living on the streets. They were nicely dressed church folk, almost all women. The crowd swelled, the space around me shrunk. I did not know a single person other than Mordecai. Sophia and Abraham were somewhere in the crowd, but I didn't see them. It was billed as the largest homeless march in the past 10 years, Lante's Rally. A photo of Lante Burton had been enlarged and mass-produced on large placards, trimmed in black, and under her face were the ominous words, "Who killed Lante?" These were dispersed through the crowd and quickly became the placard of choice, even among the men from CCNV who'd brought their own protest banners. Lante's face bobbed and weaved above the mass of people. A lone siren wailed in the distance, then grew closer. A funeral van with a police escort was allowed through the barricades and stopped directly in front of the district building in the midst of the throng. The rear doors opened, a mock casket painted black was removed by the pallbearers, 6 homeless men who lifted it onto their shoulders and stood ready to begin the procession. 4 more caskets, same color and make but much smaller, were removed by more pallbearers. The sea parted. The procession moved slowly toward the steps as the choir launched into a soulful requiem that almost brought tears to my eyes. It was a death march. One of those little caskets represented Ontario. Then the crowd pressed together. Hands reached upward and touched the caskets so that they floated along, rocking gently side to side, end to end. It was high drama, and the cameras packed near the platform recorded every solemn movement of the procession. We would see it replayed on TV for the next 48 hours.
The caskets were placed side by side, with Lante's in the middle, on a small plywood ledge in the center of the steps, a few feet below the platform where Mordecai stood. They were filmed and photographed at length. Then the speeches started. The moderator was an activist who began by thanking all the groups that had helped organize the march. It was an impressive list, at least in quantity. As he rattled off the names, I was pleasantly surprised at the sheer number of shelters, missions, kitchens, coalitions, medical clinics, legal clinics, churches, centers, outreach groups, job training programs, substance abuse programs, even a few elected officials, all responsible to some degree for the event. With so much support, how could there be a homeless problem? The next six speakers answered that question. Lack of adequate funding to begin with, then budget cuts. A deaf ear by the federal government, a blind eye by the city, a lack of compassion from those with means, a court system grown much too conservative, the list went on and on, and on and on. The same themes were repeated by each speaker except for Mordecai, who spoke fifth and silenced the crowd with his story of the last hours of the Burton family. When he told of changing the baby's diaper, probably its last one, there wasn't a sound in the crowd, not a cough or a whisper. I looked at the caskets as if one actually held the baby. Then the family left the shelter, he explained, his voice slow, deep, resonating. They went back into the streets, into the snowstorm, where Lante and her children survived only a few more hours. Mordecai took great license with the facts at that point, because no one knew exactly what had happened. I knew this, but I didn't care. The rest of the crowd was equally mesmerized by his story. When he described the last moments, as the family huddled together in a futile effort to stay warm, I heard women crying around me. My thoughts turned selfish. If this man, my friend and fellow lawyer, could captivate a crowd of thousands from an elevated platform 100 feet away, what could he do with 12 people in a jury box close enough to touch? I realized at that moment that the Burton lawsuit would never get that far. No defense team in its right mind would allow Mordecai Green to preach to a black jury in this city. If our assumptions were correct, and if we could prove them, there would never be a trial. After an hour and a half of speeches, the crowd was restless and ready to walk. The choir began again, and the caskets were lifted by the pallbearers, who led the procession away from the building. Behind the caskets were the leaders, including Mordecai. The rest of us followed. Someone handed me a Lante placard, and I held it as high as anyone else. Privileged people don't march and protest. Their world is safe and clean and governed by laws designed to keep them happy. I had never taken to the streets before. Why bother? And for the first block or two, I felt odd, walking in a mass of people holding a stick with a placard bearing the face of a 22-year-old black mother who bore 4 illegitimate children. But I was no longer the person I'd been a few weeks earlier. Nor could I go back, even if I'd wanted to. My past had been about money and possessions and status, afflictions that now disturbed me. And so I relaxed and enjoyed the walk. I chanted with the homeless, rolled and pitched my placard in perfect unison with the others, and even tried to sing hymns foreign to me. I savored my first exercise in civil protest. It wouldn't be my last. The barricades protected us as we inched toward Capitol Hill. The march had been well planned, and because of its size, it attracted attention along the way. The caskets were placed on the steps of the Capitol. We congregated in a mass around them, then listened to another series of fiery speeches from civil rights activists and 2 members of Congress. The speeches grew old. I'd heard enough. My homeless brethren had little to do. I had opened 31 files since beginning my new career on Monday. 31 real people were waiting for me to get food stamps, locate housing, file divorces, defend criminal charges, obtain disputed wages, stop evictions, help with their addictions, and in some way snap my fingers and find justice. As an antitrust lawyer, I rarely had to face the clients. Things were different on the street. I bought a cheap cigar from a sidewalk vendor and went for a short walk on the mall. Chapter 25. I knocked on the door next to where the Palmers had lived, and a woman's voice asked, "Who's there?" There was no effort to unbolt and open. I had thought long and hard about my ploy. I'd even rehearsed it, driving to Bethesda. But I was not convinced I could be convincing. "Bob Stevens," I said, cringing. "I'm looking for Hector Palma."
"Who?"
"Hector Palma. He used to live next door to you."
"What do you want?"
"I owe him some money. I'm trying to find him, that's all." If I were collecting money or had some other unpleasant mission, then the neighbors would naturally be defensive. I thought this was a nifty little ruse.
"He's gone," she said flatly.
"I know he's gone. Do you know where he went?"
"No."
"Did he leave this area?"
"Dunno."
"Did you see them move?" Of course, the answer was yes. There was no way around it. But instead of being helpful, she withdrew into the depths of her apartment and probably called security. I repeated the question, then rang the doorbell again. Nothing. So I went to the door on the other side of Hector's last known address. Two rings, it opened slightly until the chain caught, and a man my age, with mayonnaise in the corner of his mouth, said,
"What do you want?"
I repeated the Bob Stevens plot. He listened carefully while his kids romped through the living room behind him, a television blasting away. It was after 8, dark and cold, and I'd interrupted a late dinner. But he was not unpleasant.
"I never knew him," he said.
"What about his wife?"
"Nope. I travel a lot, gone all the time."
"Did your wife know them?"
"No."
He said this too quickly. "Did you or your wife see them move last weekend?"
"We weren't here last weekend."
"And you have no idea where they went?"
"None."
I thanked him, then turned around to meet a beefy security guard in uniform, holding a billy club with his right hand and tapping it on his left palm like a street cop in a movie.
"What are you doing?" he snarled.
"Looking for someone," I said. "Put that thing away."
"We don't allow solicitation."
"Are you deaf? I'm looking for someone, not soliciting." I walked past him toward the parking lot.
"We've had a complaint," he said to my back. "You need to leave."
"I'm leaving." Dinner was a taco and a beer in a corporate bar not far away. I felt safer eating in the suburbs. The restaurant was of the cookie-cutter variety, a national chain getting rich with shiny new neighborhood watering holes. The crowd was dominated by young government workers still trying to get home, all talking policy and politics while drinking draft beer and yelling at a game on the tube. Loneliness was an adjustment. My wife and friends had been left behind. 7 years in the sweatshop of Drake and Sweeney had not been conducive to nurturing friendships, or a marriage either, for that matter. At the age of 32, I was ill-prepared for the single life. As I watched the game and the women, I asked myself if I were expected to return to the bar and nightclub scene to find companionship. Surely there was some other place and method. I got dejected and left. I drove slowly into the city, not anxious to arrive at my apartment. My name was on a lease in a computer somewhere, and I figured the police could find my loft without too much trouble. If they were planning an arrest, I was certain it would happen at night. They would enjoy terrifying me with a midnight knock on the door, a little roughing up as they frisked me and slapped on the cuffs, a shove out the door, down the elevator with death grips under my arms, a push into the rear seat of a squad car for the ride to the city jail, where I would be the only young white professional arrested that night. They would like nothing better than to throw me into a holding cell with the usual assortment of thugs and leave me there to fend for myself. I carried with me two things, regardless of what I was doing. One was a cell phone with which to call Mordecai as soon as I was arrested. The other was a folded stack of bills, $20 bills, with which to make bail and hopefully spring myself before I got near the holding cell. I parked two blocks away from my building and watched every empty car for suspicious characters. I made it to the loft, untouched, unapprehended. My living room was now furnished with two lawn chairs and a plastic storage box used as a coffee table footstool. The television was on a matching storage box. I was amused at the sparse furnishings and determined to keep the place to myself. No one would see how I was living. My mother had called. I listened to her recording. She and Dad were worried about me and wanted to come for a visit. They had discussed things with Brother Warner, and he might make the trip too. I could almost hear their analysis of my new life. Somebody had to talk some sense into me. The rally for Lante was the lead story at 11. There were close-ups of the five black caskets lying on the steps of the district building, and later as they were marched down the street. Mordecai was featured preaching to the masses. The crowd appeared larger than I had realized. The estimate was 5,000. The mayor had no comment. I turned off the television and punched Claire's number on the phone. We had not talked in 4 days, and I thought I would show some civility and break the ice. Technically, we were still married. It would be nice to have dinner in a week or so. After the third ring, a strange voice reluctantly said, "Hello?" It was that of a male. For a second, I was too stunned to speak. It was 11:30 on a Thursday night. Claire had a man over. I had been gone for less than a week. I almost hung up, but then collected myself and said, "Claire, please." "Who's calling?" he asked gruffly. "Michael, her husband." "She's in the shower," he said with a trace of satisfaction. "Tell her I called," I said, and hung up as quickly as possible. I paced the three rooms until midnight, then dressed again and went for a walk in the cold. When a marriage crumbles, you ponder all scenarios. Was it a simple matter of growing apart, or was it much more complicated than that? Had I missed the signals? Was he a casual one-nighter, or had they been seeing each other for years? Was he some overheated doctor, married, with children, or a young, virile med student giving her what she'd missed from me? I kept telling myself it didn't matter. We weren't divorcing because of infidelities. It was too late to worry if she'd been sleeping around. The marriage was over, plain and simple, for whatever reason. She could go to hell for all I cared. She was done, dismissed, forgotten. If I was free to chase the ladies, then the same rules applied to her. Yeah, right. At 2 a.m., I found myself at DuPont Circle, ignoring catcalls from the queers and stepping around men bundled in layers and quilts and sleeping on benches. It was dangerous, but I didn't care. A few hours later, I bought a box of a dozen assorted at a Krispy Kreme with two tall coffees and a newspaper. Ruby was waiting faithfully at the door, shivering from the cold. Her eyes were redder than usual. Her smile was not as quick. Our spot was a desk in the front, the one with the fewest stacks of long-forgotten files. I cleared the top of the desk and served the coffee and donuts. She didn't like chocolate, but instead preferred the ones with the fruit filling. "Do you read the newspaper?" I asked as I unfolded it.
"No."
"How well do you read?"
"Not good."
So I read it to her. We started with the front page, primarily because it had a large photo of the five caskets seemingly adrift above the mass of people. The story was headlined across the bottom half, and I read every word of it to Ruby, who listened intently. She had heard stories about the deaths of the Burton family. The details fascinated her.
"Could I die like that?" she asked.
"No, not unless your car has an engine and you run the heater."
"I wish it had a heater."
"You could die from exposure."
"What's that?"
"Freezing to death." She wiped her mouth with a napkin and sipped her coffee. The temperature had been 11 degrees the night Ontario and his family died. How had Ruby survived? "Where do you go when it gets real cold?" I asked.
"Don't go nowhere."
"You stay in the car?"
"Yes."
"How do you keep from freezing?"
"I got plenty of blankets. I just bury down in 'em."
"You never go to a shelter?"
"Never."
"Would you go to a shelter if it would help you see Terrence?" She rolled her head to one side and gave me a strange look.
"Say it again," she said.
"You want to see Terrence, right?"
"Right."
"Then you have to get clean, right?"
Right.
To get clean, you'll have to live in a detox center for a while. Is that something you're willing to do?
Maybe, she said. Just maybe.
It was a small step, but not an insignificant one. I can help you see Terrence again, and you can be a part of his life. But you have to get clean and stay clean.
How do I do it?
She asked, her eyes unable to meet mine. She cradled her coffee, the steam rising to her face. Are you going to Naomi's today?
Yes.
I talked to the director yesterday. They have two meetings today for alcoholics and drug addicts together. They're called AANA. I want you to attend both of them. The director will call me. She nodded like a scolded child. I would push no further, not at that moment. She nibbled her donuts, sipped her coffee, and listened with rapt attention as I read one news story after another. She cared little for foreign affairs and sports, but the city news fascinated her. She had voted at one time, many years ago, and the politics of the district were easily digested. She understood the crime stories. A long editorial blistered Congress and the city for their failure to fund services for the homeless. Other Lantes would follow, it warned. Other children would die in our streets, in the shadows of the U.S. Capitol. I paraphrase this for Ruby, who concurred with every phrase. A soft, freezing rain began falling, so I drove Ruby to her next stop for the day. Naomi's Women's Center was a four-level row house on 10th Street Northwest, in a block of similar structures. It opened at 7, closed at 4, and during each day provided food, showers, clothing, activities, and counseling for any homeless woman who could find the place. Ruby was a regular and received a warm greeting from her friends when we entered. I spoke quietly with the director, a young woman named Megan. We conspired to push Ruby toward sobriety. Half the women there were mentally ill, half were substance abusers, a third were HIV positive. Ruby, as far as Megan knew, carried no infectious diseases. When I left, the women were crowded in the main room, singing songs. I was hard at work at my desk when Sophia knocked on my door and entered before I could answer.
Mordecai says you're looking for someone,
she said. She held a legal pad ready to take notes. I thought for a second, then remembered Hector. Oh, yes, I am.
I can help. Tell me everything you know about the person.
She sat down and began writing as I rattled off his name, address, last known place of employment, physical description, and the fact that he had a wife and four kids.
Age?
Maybe 30.
Approximate salary?
35,000.
With four kids, it's safe to assume at least one was enrolled in school. With that salary and living in Bethesda, I doubt if they'd go the private route. He's Hispanic, so he's probably Catholic. Anything else?
I couldn't think of a thing. She left and returned to her desk, where she opened a thick three-ring notebook and flipped pages. I kept my door open so I could watch and listen. The first call went to someone with the postal service. The conversation changed instantly to Spanish, and I was lost. One call followed another. She would say hello in English, ask for her contact, then switch to her native tongue. She called the Catholic diocese, which led to another series of rapid calls. I lost interest. An hour later, she walked to my door and announced,
"They moved to Chicago. Do you need an address?"
"How did you..." My words trailed off as I stared at her in disbelief.
"Don't ask. A friend of a friend in their church. They moved over the weekend in a hurry. Do you need their new address?"
"How long will it take?"
"It won't be easy. I can point you in the right direction."
She had at least six clients sitting along the front window waiting to seek her advice. "Not now," I said. "Maybe later. Thanks."
"Don't mention it."
"Don't mention it." I'd planned to spend a few more hours after dark knocking on the doors of neighbors, in the cold, dodging security guards, hoping no one shot me. And she worked the phone for an hour and found the missing person. Drake and Sweeney had more than 100 lawyers in its Chicago branch. I'd been there twice on antitrust cases. The offices were in a skyscraper near the lakefront. The building's foyer was several stories tall, with fountains and shops around the perimeter, escalators zigzagging upward.
It was the perfect place to hide and watch for Hector Palma.
Chapter 26. The homeless are close to the streets, to the pavement, the curbs and gutters, the concrete, the litter, the sewer lids and fire hydrants and wastebaskets and bus stops and storefronts. They move slowly over familiar terrain day after day, stopping to talk to each other because time means little, stopping to watch a stalled car in traffic, a new drug dealer on a corner, a strange face on their turf. They sit on their sidewalks hidden under hats and caps and behind drugstore sunshades, and like sentries they observe every movement. They hear the sounds of the street. They absorb the odors of diesel fumes from city buses and fried grease from cheap diners. The same cab passes twice in an hour, and they know it. A gun is fired in the distance, and they know where it came from. A fine auto with Virginia or Maryland plates is parked at the curb. They'll watch it until it leaves. A cop with no uniform waits in a car with no markings, and they see it.
"The police are out there," one of our clients said to Sophia.
She walked to the front door, looked southeast on Kew, and there she saw what appeared to be an unmarked police car. She waited half an hour and checked it again. Then she went to Mordecai. I was oblivious because I was fighting with the food stamp office on one front and the prosecutor's office on another. It was late Friday afternoon, and the city bureaucracy, substandard on a good day, was shutting down fast. They delivered the news together.
"I think the cops might be waiting," Mordecai announced solemnly.
My first reaction was to duck under the desk, but of course I did not. I tried to appear quite calm.
"Where?" I asked, as if it mattered.
"At the corner. They've been watching the building for more than a half hour."
"Maybe they're coming after you," I said.
Ha ha, stone faces all around.
"I've called," Sophia said, "and there's a warrant for your arrest, grand larceny."
"A felony? Prison? A handsome white boy thrown into the pit?" I shifted weight from one side to another, and I tried my best to show no fear.
"That's no surprise," I said. "Happen all the time. Let's get it over with."
"I have a call in for a guy at the prosecutor's office," Mordecai said. "It would be nice if they allowed you to turn yourself in."
"That would be nice," I said, as if it didn't really matter.
"But I've been talking to the prosecutor's office all afternoon. No one's listening."
"They have 200 lawyers," he said.
Mordecai did not make friends on that side of the street. Cops and prosecutors were his natural enemies. A quick game plan was devised. Sophia would call a bail bondsman who would meet us at the jail. Mordecai would try to find a friendly judge. What was not said was the obvious. It was late Friday afternoon. I might not survive a weekend in the city jail. They left to make their calls, and I sat at my desk, petrified, unable to move or think or do anything but listen for the squeaking of the front door. I didn't have to wait long. At precisely 4 p.m., Lieutenant Gasco entered with a couple of his men behind him. During my first encounter with Gasco, when he was searching Claire's apartment, when I was ranting and taking names and threatening all sorts of vile litigation against him and his buddies, when every word uttered by him was met with a caustic retort from me, when I was a hard-charging lawyer and he was a lowly cop, it never occurred to me that he one day might have the pleasure of arresting me. But there he was, swaggering like an aging jock, somehow sneering and smiling at the same time, holding yet more papers, folded, and just waiting to be slapped against my chest.
This book is continued on Disc 7.